We made this.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me again this week for this episode, which is all about Billy Wilder's film Some Like It Hot from 1959. Of course, the famous comedy with Marilyn Monroe, Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, etc. And I'm joined by my good friend Tony Black on this episode. Hey, Tony.
Hey, sugar.
I knew that was coming.
Oh, yeah, I knew it was coming. Had to be done.
It's actually, I was looking back and I think the last episode you and I were on together was Goldfinger, actually.
Goldfinger. Yeah. Blimey, that was a while ago.
It was. Before that, Mary Poppins with Sarah.
Yep.
So I think we have to go all the way back to Night of the Hunter for a time when it was just the two of us on an episode together. So yeah, kind of glad to have you to myself today.
Yeah. Cheers. It's really nice to be back on talking. Well, I wouldn't say this is a conventional film really in many ways, but it's just nice to be on doing something a bit bright and breezy.
Yeah, it's nice to do something that's a bit kind of divorced from the current situation and stuff. What are your thoughts on the current moment though? I mean, like, how are things with you? And it's just crazy, isn't it? It's like a really weird time. I think
it's strange. I'm all right. I'm not doing too bad. I'm doing a hell of a lot of podcasting, which I'm slowly beginning to feel a level of slight burnout. So I might need to, in the next couple of weeks, have a little bit of a break. Just not a full break, but just sort of wind that down. But apart from that, not bad. It's a surreal situation because if you're not unwell and you're not working, you don't have people in your direct family who are going out and working on the front line, or, you know, I think you get a different experience to something like this as sort of an observer. It's like you're at home and it's fairly quiet and pleasant, and then you look at the news and it's terrible. So it's an unusual situation.
And it's weird, isn't it? Because it's been quite a prolonged period of time, and I don't know, there's kind of a danger of getting kind of numb to all the, you know, the rising numbers and stuff like that. And I don't know, I just have some days where things hit more than others, you know?
Yeah, it's... You've got to be careful not to just let it become, as they say, the new normal. And, you know, because nothing about this is normal. I'm recording a podcast at like 10 a.m. on a Thursday. That's not normal.
Yeah. Okay, before we get to Some Like It Hot, let's talk a bit about the fact that the Movie Palace has joined the We Made This podcast network, which I mentioned on last week's episode quickly, but with an eye to talking about it a bit more here. So I dare say you've mentioned We Made This in passing on some of your previous appearances, perhaps, but I don't know. Do you want to kind of tee it up for people? Like, what exactly has the Movie Palace joined? What have I got myself into?
Well, that's the question. Well, firstly, I'm delighted the Movie Palace is on the network, which is a pop culture podcast network, I guess is the best way to describe it, focusing on cinema, television, music. We've also got a couple of podcasts about holistic stuff, like a show called Life's Milestones, which is all about the process of life and things like that, like a very humanistic kind of podcast. So, but generally, we're in that sort of arena. So the Movie Palace has sort of joined a collective of shows that are looking back at classic telly or films, or covering newer things. And just generally, it's a sort of collective of podcasters who are in a similar kind of wheelhouse, I suppose. But I'm really pleased the Movie Palace is on the network, because I think it's already a really established, excellent show, and I think it will bring a lot to We Made This, and hopefully vice versa, really.
Yeah, don't expect too much, that's what I'd say. But no, it's
lower my expectations, yeah.
It's good to be on board. And I think fans of this podcast, I mean, they may well know already, but I think our mutual friend Gabriella Masson, she's got some stuff on the network, hasn't she, for instance, that people would possibly be interested in checking out, like her Joan Crawford podcast, for instance.
Yeah, You Won't Forget Me, which is I think anyone who likes the movie Palace, I think will enjoy. I know you've had a Joan Crawford episode on, and you've done that, and you've had Gabriella on, obviously. And yeah, and she's doing other podcasts. Like, she's got one coming up, I think, called By Projection Light, where she's talking about classic cinema as well, more generally. So yeah, there's lots to enjoy. We've got some sort of connective sort of tissue in terms of a podcast that's going to come out as a sitting alongside the Movie Palace in the next couple of months. So yeah, there's some exciting stuff to come.
Yeah, look out for a crossover of sorts in the not too distant future, hopefully, on that. But yeah, stay tuned for more updates soon, listeners. All right then, so Some Like It Hot. So yeah, I think the thinking here was just that, I mean, we did the lockdown episode last week. I thought it'd be good to do something lighthearted for the first full film discussion back. And I thought, you know, Some Like It Hot was a very strong contender to be that film. So what are your general thoughts on the film? And like, this wasn't your first watch, was it? I think this is one you'd seen a while ago. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. I'd have to look at Letterboxd probably to pin down when I first saw the film, because that's how I keep track of my film watching. But it was some years ago, I think. I think it was around 5-6 years ago, maybe longer. And I loved it the first time around, and I thought it was just really funny and sweet. And you know, as somebody, and I've said before on this podcast, I'm not learned in classic cinema to the extent I'd like to be, and I hope to be in the future. But so I hadn't seen a lot of films, particularly comedies, from that period, the late 50s. But it really, really stood out to me as something that hadn't really, in some senses, aged, you know, and felt very fresh and still really funny, and the jokes made sense. I had a very similar experience second time around, even knowing what was coming, really, because a lot of the incidental details had sort of faded from memory a little bit, as they do when you only watch a film once. And it was rediscovering it again was delightful, absolutely delightful. And I just had a great time second time around. I think it really is one of those films that you just, I just don't think it ever depreciates, really.
Yeah, really good. I think it's a very, very enjoyable film. I mean, I watched it with my partner and our son, which is interesting this time. I've seen this film a few times before. So Becky, she thought it was all right. Didn't really hear her laughing. My son was bored. I mean, his attention span is not the greatest. Yeah. But and it's black and white and it's old, etc. I was laughing away, so that was good. I mean, how much were you laughing out loud, and how much is this comedy that you're like smiling at, you know? What kind of level was it working at?
I don't know if it was laugh out loud, because I think maybe some of the particular incidental jokes might have been lost a little bit to time now, possibly. You know, maybe certain reference points and things like that. But I don't know if that's just a personal thing. You know, I imagine there are a lot of people who would be laughing out loud at this. I definitely did laugh out loud at a couple of particular points. Obviously, that final line as well, which is, I'm sure we'll talk about, but it is just absolute, you know, an absolute riot. But yeah, it was just it's a different kind of film in terms of comedy than something that's a little bit more obvious. I mean, I'm a sucker for slapstick, and I'm a sucker for, you know, the kind of obvious and gross out kind of comedies that we grew up watching when we were kids. So this has got a little bit more nuance, I think. And so a bit of a mixture. I laughed at some points quite heartily, but quite a lot of smiling, throughout.
Yeah, and I was wondering whether that was some of the kind of relative trouble that my family members were having. That I don't think this is a film that necessarily goes for all the obvious gags. You know, I think a lot of the humour is actually from quite a sophisticated use of language, for instance.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of lines that aren't always necessarily big punchlines, you know. The thing that might not give you a belly laugh, but it might make you smile. So the thing about Sugar, when she says her father was a conductor on the Baltimore and Ohio, that kind of thing, which is a really clever gag.
Yeah.
And that's the interesting thing here as well, is that like Billy Wilder is probably one of my favourite directors of this, certainly this era, of all directors really. But this is not necessarily my favourite of his films. Like, there are at least five I would put above Some Like It Hot. And I'm thinking Double Indemnity, Ace in the Hole, Sunset Boulevard, The Apartment. I've got a very sentimental attachment to a film called Avanti as well.
I've heard of that, yeah.
Yeah, but I think like that's not to disparage Some Like It Hot. I think it's very, very enjoyable. And I think it's actually a significant film for several reasons, and we can get into some of this. But because it's one of the best loved films by Wilder, who, again, in my judgment, I think he's one of the finest directors to flourish in this kind of era, classical era Hollywood.
Mm.
And one of the most interesting of those filmmakers who came to Hollywood from Europe, people like Fritz Lang, Lubitsch. Probably the most well-known film that stars one of Hollywood's most enduring kind of icons in Marilyn Monroe. And I think it's just an extremely well-constructed farce. You know, I think it all fits together really well. Let's start with some like background detail. And I don't know what you've come across in your kind of research and stuff. But a film that it's kind of a loose remake. It takes much of its premise from a German film from 1951 called Fanfare und der Liebe.
Mm.
That in itself was a remake of a 1935 film called Fanfare d'Amour from France. Some Like It Hot won one Oscar for Best Costume Design in Black and White for Ori Kelly's work, and it had five other nominations. So just quickly, Best Actor for Lemon, Best Director for Wilder, Best Screenplay for Wilder and IAL Diamond, Best Black and White Cinematography from Charles Lang, and Best Black and White Art Direction and Set Decoration for Ted Haworth and Edward G. Boyle. And like you say, it's a film that has held up very well over the years and continues to be very highly regarded. So I think it was interesting that it was voted the greatest comedy of all time in a 2017 BBC Culture poll. So that's just a bit of context. But I don't know, I've only got a couple of tidbits about the making of the film. I don't know what you've come across, because I know you've been watching stuff on a DVD that I haven't got, for instance. What have you learned in that respect?
Well, I mean, the DVD that I picked up, because there doesn't seem to be, unless I've missed it, there doesn't seem to be a wealth of releases that have a lot of stuff on Some Like It Hot. Strangely, it feels like, you know, it's bizarre that a particular company hasn't picked this one up and got loads for it. So on the DVD, it's mainly recollections, particularly from Tony Curtis, who obviously plays Joe, and speaking to Leonard Maltin, which is a really nice conversation. And he's talking more about the reception of Some Like It Hot and how it's, you know, its legacy. But also, I think a lot about the actual production itself as opposed to more about the background. You know, he talks, I suppose, about how he was cast in it, and how it was originally supposed to be potentially him and Frank Sinatra, actually, which which was interesting. Frank Sinatra didn't turn up for the audition, apparently, for the role of Jerry. But it was, and there were other candidates. Jerry Lewis was another one, who was a good friend of Tony Curtis at the time. But I think it would have been an interesting proposition seeing Frank Sinatra particularly playing the role that Jack Lemmon played. But it would have made for a different kind of film, I think, different kind of thing. But yeah, so there's not a vast amount really more that I suppose I found out about it in terms of the background, but more about that, I suppose, like I say, the Tony Curtis side, and more about the specific production and about particularly Marilyn Monroe and how she found it very difficult, I think, for making this film, which is ironic because she's fantastic all the way through, really.
Yeah. The famous Curtis quote you hear going around is where he supposedly said that, like, kissing Monroe was like kissing Hitler. Did he repeat that?
No, well, he denied that, actually.
Oh, okay.
He denies that to Leonard Maltin because it's brought up. And he says, I never said it. You know, he's like in his Brooklyn accent. He's like, I never said it. I never said that. Kissing Hitler, I never said it. and who knows? I mean, like any of these classics that are Hollywood stars, I think there is some good side and bad side and light and dark, and it's all sort of mashed up between, you know. I mean, I always did wonder, I mean, you might know this, but I always did wonder about what that might have meant exactly, because if he did say it, it's a strange thing to say, you know?
Yeah, I think the general sense I get is that I think he talked about frustration at working with Monroe, or I think that was the sense I got, that not turning up on time, stuff like that, having trouble with her lines. And again, I don't know, because again, it's one of those things where it's like you only get one side of a story and people's recollections change over time. I think all we can really go off are, you know, we can see how reliable the various sources we can find are, and we can judge what we see on screen, can't we? And like you say, Monroe's like particularly fantastic in this film. That's interesting what you said about Sinatra. I can't imagine that working quite as well, because Lemon's kind of a natural for Jerry, who's more of like a loser type figure, isn't he? And like, I can't really see Sinatra fitting. It would have been a very different dynamic, I think.
It would have been. And I mean, Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon knew each other socially before this. And I think Curtis was happy with the choice, because he immediately sort of brings a very deliberate sort of zany comic sensibility to it, Jack Lemmon, whereas I think Sinatra would have struggled with not being the one who's wooing Marilyn Monroe, for one thing. You know, I think he'd have wanted to play Joe, realistically. But and equally, I don't know if Tony Curtis would have been as good as Jerry, because I think there's a different energy to him. So I think they, for even though it wasn't necessarily the first plan, I think, because it was always seemed to be Tony Curtis. He always seemed to be in the frame, particularly off the back of Houdini that he made with Janet Leigh, his wife at the time, in the early early 50s. And that was where Wilder said he wanted him in the film. So he was always in the frame. But then I think it probably could have worked with Jerry Lewis, possibly, in the Jerry role. But then it might have just been a bit too obvious, because Jerry Lewis was already quite famous at that point, I think. Or he was, you know, so it's one of those where, and it quite frequently happens, doesn't it? It's not the first choice, but it tends to be the in the end, the best choice for it.
Yeah.
But then nor was Marilyn. She wasn't. They didn't even think they'd get her at first. I think they were imagining someone like Mitzi Gaynor. So it wasn't even Marilyn Monroe at first and then she expressed an interest, and they were like, of course, let's get her in, you know, and the rest is history.
Yeah, well, that's because I think it's very hard to imagine it working as well without Lemon and without Curtis, but I think particularly so without Monroe. That's what I think. I think like she's indelible in that part.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about, so we talked about the particular type of humor we get here in Some Like It Hot. For me, a lot of the pleasure in the film is just kind of marveling at how cleverly the pieces are put together. And often that's to do with the dialogue, but not always. And like, one thing I've picked up over the years, and I think more so in the past than now, maybe, but there was some hesitation in some quarters previously at giving Wilder a place at like the top table of great directors. And I think the reason is that he lacked perhaps as readily identifiable a visual style as somebody like Alfred Hitchcock, for instance.
Mm.
You know, where people can look at a Hitchcock film for just a couple of minutes and you know it's by Hitchcock. You perhaps can't do that with Wilder. And I think in some ways that's kind of unfair, because in the case of Some Like It Hot, I think there's more going on visually than it might appear at first glance. And I think a lot of it is kind of subtle stuff, like the use of close-ups is really good. I think a lot of it's to do with like the physicality, like people in motion. Like I think what I'm saying is it's more than just a screenplay here that happens to have been filmed. You know, it's not just a funny script put to film. And some of that's to do with the style. Like, I think he makes some very shrewd choices. So one interesting one is that decision to go for black and white over colour. And from what I can gather, Wilder felt it was better for presenting Lemon and Curtis as women. You know, that possibly the illusion wouldn't have been as convincing in colour. So stuff like that. And I also think the use of music in the film is very enriching. You know, I think all the songs Monroe performs are really good, but especially that final one, you know, I'm Through With Love, towards the end, which is like the catalyst for Joe's transformation. So I think, like I say, there's more going on here than just sparkling dialogue, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And it was interesting that in her contract, Marilyn Monroe demanded it in colour at first. She said, I won't do it unless it's a colour picture. And then when she saw the reality of Curtis and Lemon as women in colour, she was like, oh, okay. but it adds, I don't know, weirdly, I think it adds something to the whole thing, maybe because it's set in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And I think it having it in black and white aids to that period feel that Wilder goes for, you know, and because originally I think they didn't know if they were going to set it in that period. And then they decided actually, I'm sure you were going to talk about this, but the reason they did that is because they needed a reason for Joe and Jerry to go to Florida, really, that was more than just deciding to go. So tying it into a version of like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and the gangster era was a way to sort of land it in a period style. So those kind of choices, I think, are key to how the film looks, not just in terms of plotting, but how the film actually looks and how choices like the black and white do make it more an interesting film. And I think there are some nice, but one thing he does as a director, which might have probably was scripted, I don't know, but just the way he executes it with his camera that really I didn't notice first time round, was when they get to the hotel and Jerry goes in the lift with Osgood, and then the lift goes up and Osgood's about to try it on, and the clock goes and then it goes and then come back out. A fantastic knob gag without being overtly coarse. And I thought, that's just really good. That's just that made me laugh out loud. I tell you, that was a great moment. The little things like that.
Yeah, I think the fact that it's these gangsters, albeit, you know, quite comic gangsters, but I think that's why the black and white works particularly well, because you would expect the gangster genre was one genre that was always almost invariably in black and white, you know, often because they were kind of realistic stories with topical kind of subject matter. So I think it works with that. But in any case, yeah, so I think there's stuff going on there. And yeah, there are some good sight gags, great reactions, some good physical comedy. But the thing I always almost always come away from Wilder's films thinking is about just how fantastic they are on the level of the screenplay. And the comparison I would make is it's like watching a Swiss watch being assembled. And like a Swiss watch is a beautiful thing to look at when it's finished, but it's also kind of, I imagine, quite interesting to look at when you pull the pieces apart, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And in ways that are sometimes immediately apparent, and other times they're things that you might not pick up on until a second or a third viewing, you know? So I think what this film does really well is it takes an engaging starting point, which is quite credible. So you've got two musicians who need work, and they're in some level of physical peril. They have to go on the run. And you sort of, it takes 20 minutes or so to really establish that premise, and then it just ratchets up the absurdity, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it plants the seeds for all that very well. So it's not that, for instance, the idea of the guys dressing up as women is actually knocked down, isn't it, when they initially bring it up. But it kind of plants it earlier.
Mm.
And it establishes the characters really well. Like, we get a sense, don't we, that Joe's this kind of hustler figure. You know, we see him convince that secretary into giving him the car. We see him giving, you know, he's kind of the bossy one in the relationship with Jerry, isn't he? Like, we're going to do this with the money. Don't worry, it'll all be okay.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, it takes its time doing that. And what that means is it can kind of glide over some later details because it's put the groundwork in. So it's like, what exactly does happen between them escaping that shooting and then turning up for the train dressed as women, you know? But it's okay. We know that Joe's somebody who can kind of be persuasive and get what he wants, you know? And then it just develops this sense of, like, kinetic energy. So, like, literally, in the case of the train sequences, like, they're in motion. But also, like, the comings and goings in Miami when we get there. So not only is that, like, really enjoyable to watch, so some of the physicality, like the climbing up the sides of buildings or, you know, running for the boat. Sometimes it's even tense, you know, that moment. And it's kind of subtle, but, like, when Joe's forgot to take the earrings off. And it's like, will he notice that he's still wearing them in time, or will he get caught out?
But it's funny as well. It's tense and funny. Like, that, yeah. But that scene, I was laughing and going, oh, no, he's done it.
It's really good.
Yeah.
But all that stuff, I think it means that the audience, because the film's got this level of energy that doesn't really let up once it's got going, you never really have time to think about how incredible some of the situations really are. I think it establishes that really well.
What struck me was how... Well, it manages to... there's a very sort of clear first act, second act, third act, in a way, structure to this, because the first act is all the stuff in the city and then they escape. That middle act is Miami, and then the final act is still Miami, but then the gangsters show up. And it surprised me how well, and I think it's a testament to the script and the set pieces, in how well it manages to, for a good, probably a good hour, forget the gangsters even exist, really. And then suddenly George Raft and his crew turn up and it collides the two things together. But you never feel in that course midsection that there is a problem and that the story and the plot and the film isn't working. Because what it's doing is it's really sort of hooking into... Because really, the gangsters are immaterial. They're just part of the catalyst for, you know, the idea of exploring... Like you say, this farcical situation of two men pretending to be women falling in love with a woman while a man falls in love with the other one, you know, the other fake woman. So there's lots of, like, that's the real core of it. That, and you can see why it has this European, source material in a way, because it's very farcical and it's very much a... And I suppose that's why it was a little bit, if not necessarily taboo breaking, but it was certainly challenging, like... The thing, like, you know, things like the production code at the time, wasn't it, in terms of how it was daring to put on, well, for starters, put two male actors in drag and have them spend most of the film dressed as women and pretending to be women without necessarily touching on homosexuality as such. But there are hints of it in there and there are coded things and stuff going on. So in that sense, I think it's quite fresh in that it's slightly different from maybe what these kind of Hollywood comedies, or if not farces, but that kind of, you know, you put in a Doris Day into a film, you know, that kind of thing. It's different from what Hollywood was potentially doing at the time.
And it's definitely, you can imagine this kind of subject matter being treated very differently in some of the British comedies of like the 50s and 60s that we're kind of familiar with, you know, the kind of sexy bedroom farces.
Yeah. Like the Carry On films.
That kind of thing, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's actually, I wanted you to talk about some of the specific gags then. And it's interesting that you said, like, maybe there's some references that people kind of don't pick up on these days. I think that's probably true. First of all, I think it cleverly, like, interweaves a lot of the gags and, like, repeats things, and there are echoes of earlier gags. So, for instance, like, when Joe and Jerry, as the women, they say that they studied at the Sheboygan Conservatory. and then, like, later on in the film, yeah. like, Sugar utilizes the same kind of background, doesn't she? Which he's trying to impress the millionaire that Curtis's character is posing as.
Yeah.
So things like that, which are really good. And it's a film where the amusement works on more levels than it may first appear. So I think the obvious example is Curtis as that millionaire. So, like, to a young audience today, like to my son, I imagine, he's just putting on a different voice to establish a distinct persona. But, of course, audiences at the time, and, like, those of us who know Cary Grant, for instance, know exactly what Curtis is doing. He's doing a, you know, he's doing his best Cary Grant impression, isn't he? He talks a bit like that. And it's really good. But there's a few things like that, I think. Like, what sort of things were you thinking of when you said that earlier about gags that maybe don't travel down the decades as such?
Well, I think just on the point of that, I was thinking a little bit of Tony Curtis's, you know, fake millionaire as well. Just on the point of that, the whole idea that Sugar, really actually loves the idea of, like, a, you know, a handsome, intelligent guy with glasses who, you know, is quite, that has to be a nod to her marriage to Arthur Miller, the playwright, because if you look at him, he's got glasses, you know, he's intelligent, he's not the type you necessarily would imagine Marilyn Monroe with, but I know they were on the verge of divorce, I think, at the time this was being made, and they'd had their problems, but you know, when you wouldn't necessarily put those two together visually. So that, I think, is a gag, an inside gag in a way as well, playing to that. But yeah, I was thinking of the Sheboygan Conservatory, yeah, as well. But yeah, I think that I think when I was talking about the coded things, I was talking as well about how it feels like there is a little bit of a level of subversion to the comedy that is, you know, prefiguring how, you know, Hollywood would eventually challenge a lot of the structural sort of studio era norms of the time. You know, the whole idea of the fact that in the end, Osgood doesn't care that Jerry's a man. You know, it's things like that. The final gag is paid as just it's a bit of fun and that kind of thing. But there's something else there. There's a very there's a liberal minded aspect to this film in that it's never a film where these two men dressing up as women is something that they should be wrong for doing, ever. It's never that. It's always that it's played for the comedy of the misconstrued relationships. And I think that's why it's a little bit, maybe slightly got one eye into the future, because it's sort of suggesting that there is nothing wrong with these with gender transformations and, you know, the alternate ways of living, if you see what I mean. I think it's very subtle, but it's definitely there.
Yeah, I think that's what so like I said, Becky kind of enjoyed the film, but she was like, well, it's very stereotypical, isn't it? I was like, I don't know if it is. I think it's more subtle than you're giving it credit for. And I think that's part of it. And there are also moments like, so at the end when Josephine kisses Sugar. And, like, the thing she says is, oh, Josephine. I've seen some people read that as a subversive moment. Like, in that moment, she thinks she's been kissed by a woman, for instance. And it's just afterwards when she realizes what's going on. Now, I was thinking of, like, the Cary Grant impersonation in terms of kind of these kind of meta gags, you know. But also the fact that, we've got George Raft as Spats, the main gangster. And there's that scene, isn't there, where he passes the younger guy flipping the coin. And what that's an allusion to is the fact that Raft's character in the original Scarface in the early 1930s made a habit of that same gesture, flipping the coin.
Right, okay.
In addition, the guy flipping the coin is played by Edward G. Robinson Jr., so the son of one of the great gangster stars.
Yeah.
So it's the kind of thing, and I think it's good because it's the thing, kind of thing that's not really that distracting if you're unaware of it, but it's nice if you sort of do get what's going on, you know. George Raff, by the way, I think the interesting story about him was that he was one of those actors who was offered a lot of great roles and he had a really bad knack for his choices. Like, I think he turned down stuff like Double Indemnity, for instance, and just a string of great films that he could have done. But I think there's also a sense here, and this is what I like about the film, it's that the characters are much more interesting than you might imagine, you know. And again, it's a farce, so arguably we're after laughs here more so than like an in-depth character study. But I think there's quite a bit going on, and I think it's part of a trend in Wilder's comedies. You quite often find characters who, they find out things about themselves by adopting the identity of somebody else. Sometimes it's through disguise or impersonation, or they just end up in a situation where they take on a new persona. So I just watched The 7-Year Itch last night, where the main character in that film, he's like this Manhattan guy whose family goes away for the summer. And he sort of is toying with his feelings for Monroe's character, who plays his neighbour, for instance. But before we can talk about any of that, I think it's great casting, first of all. We kind of already said this, but Lemon's great as the weaker figure of the pair, isn't he? And Curtis, I think he's very believable as that more kind of alpha figure, you know?
But yeah, absolutely. But in a way, I felt like their relationship shifted across the film, in that there exactly were points where in a way, Jerry, in his own way, is calling the shots and Jerry's exerting his confidence a bit more. And Joe becomes the worried one. Joe becomes the one, you know, going, we can't do this kind of thing. And Jerry, so I like the way it switches around for those two to some extent.
It does, yeah.
And I think that's an intentional part of the screenplay for sure. That they're just, and it's surprising actually. Once they get to Miami, until the end, they don't have a lot of screen time at points. There's quite a lot of the time they are in different places doing different things with different characters. You know, obviously Joe has a lot of time with Sugar as he's pretending to be the millionaire. But when they do come back together and you have those moments where they're clashing and they're trying to keep the secret, it's great because they're electric together.
Yeah,
you know, and you're in the middle of that, and it's great. And then when finally, you know, George Raff turns up, you feel it all come together, and in this confluence of zany sort of comedy and just great payoff. And I think that's the thing. There's some really great payoff to everything in this. They really spend enough time building up these interrelationships that when it all does start to get, you know, dangerous at the end, and it just all comes together really well, and it works especially successfully, I think.
Yeah, well, you talked about them being electric together. One of my favourite moments is when Curtis gets out of the bathtub. You know, he's kind of raced back together, and he kind of bears down
that's
on Jerry.
Brilliant.
I think that's really good. Yeah, but I think you're right about the dynamic kind of shifting around as well, because I think the way it kicks off, we see, don't we? Like, Joe's the dominating figure here. Fritters away their money. You know, he takes the lead. It's interesting. When they're both introduced, they're kind of eyeing up women in the speakeasy, aren't they? As they're kind of playing their set. But Lemon's character is interesting. When he actually talks, he's actually really preoccupied with their financial instability. And then when they become Josephine and Daphne, in some ways that's kind of reversed. You know, Lemon's character suddenly becomes much more assertive and other aspects of his character come to light. So, yeah, it's interesting. There's some sense that by taking on the disguise of a woman, he has been kind of like psychologically liberated, you know. And I think like that's one thing Lemon does really well, is he's fantastic at playing someone who has a surprising amount of fun as a woman.
Yeah, you know, he does. And it sort of empowers him in a way. And I think I found it really... I noticed something. I don't know whether this was just me, but I'm sure at the beginning that Joe suggests their names are Josephine and Geraldine. And then once he gets to the train station, he says,
I'm Daphne.
I'm Daphne. And Joe goes, Daphne? Like that. As if to say, but that's... And so immediately, Jerry's sort of putting his own stamp on this, really. And then the way when they're on the train, the way he inadvertently has this party in his in his bunk, which is great because they're like, he's like, oh no, there's too many. And then in the end, he's loving it. And there's that great sight gag where Joe realizes what's going on, stands up, and he's like, what's Joe? Daphne, what's going on? And then Jack Lemmon just pokes his head out from all these women and goes, yeah. It wasn't my fault, wasn't me. And he just goes back in. It's just so good. So good.
It is.
But
yeah.
It's just immediately, you feel that their dynamic starts to change once they're in female clothing, which is which is a testament to how well they played the parts, because they're still Joe and Jerry, while at the same time doing a little bit of extra with it. So they're just so good in these roles.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you mentioned the name change, because I think that's actually points to something. And the fact that he changes, like you say, from Geraldine to Daphne, I think that's one of my favourite laughs in the film. And it's a very simple laugh, but it also speaks to the broader idea, because for Joe, I think posing as Josephine is more of a means to an end. I think what Jerry, he actually takes a bit of fun in the possibilities it provides for his imagination to run wild. But again, it's clever, because Joe also becomes a different man in his own right, doesn't he? And again, the film prepares the ground for that quite carefully. So it's fair to say that, you know, when he finds out about Sugar's love life issues and, like, her romantic preferences, he definitely, like, uses that knowledge for his own ends, doesn't he?
Mm.
And the film gets some, like, really good comic mileage out of him doing that. But then, that last-minute change of heart, it doesn't just come out of nowhere, and I think that's why it's so satisfying, like, because we've already had things like that earlier scene where he calls her to say that they have to leave. Like, it's not like they don't just bolt from the hotel. Like I say, I think it's very satisfying, the fact that he sees the extent of Sugar's vulnerability and he kind of alters his previous ways. So again, it's like kind of by accessing his feminine side, he undergoes this productive change in identity, doesn't he? And again, it's kind of clicks for me.
Do you think that Sugar changes, though? Or is she the fixed point? Because obviously when the reveal happens at the end and he says, you know, I'm just another one of those guys. Although we know at that point that the suggestion is that Joe is that guy that she's been running away from, but he's also not, and that he's learned and that he's evolved and that it wouldn't go the same way. But Sugar, nonetheless, doesn't, you know, recoil from that either. You know, it feels like Sugar does feel like a character, I think, who's consistently defined by a man. And maybe this is an area where the film is rooted of its time, perhaps a little bit. But, well, and because I suspect today, maybe if you made that sort of story today, ultimately Sugar wouldn't go with anybody and she'd go off on her own and she'd have her own life and she'd be liberated from that sort of repeating cycle. She wouldn't necessarily want to go with the rich millionaire for the facile reasons, but also she would break free from the, you know, the charmer who's ruined her life. I don't know, but I don't know if she necessarily changes, but I don't think it's a bad thing, because I think ultimately, in the end, like you say, they've done enough with that relationship for you to believe that Joe actually really does care about Sugar, and that he wouldn't become that thing that she's run away from, that charmer who then turns into an abusive alcoholic, basically. So I think there's some interest. I don't know what you think about that, but do you think that she has that level of character development?
I think the change is that she goes from being somebody who's very attracted to the, you know, the millionaire's kind of materialistic offerings, and then by the end of it, she's fallen head over heels for a kind of out of, a reformed saxophone player without those kind of means, you know?
Yeah.
So I think what the film is doing, I think it's paralleling Daphne and Sugar, and I think it's paralleling Joe and Osgood. So if you think about Daphne and Sugar, they seem to strike up a strong bond, you know, together, personal bond. So he, as Jerry, has been treated as a bit of a doormat by a womanizing saxophone player. And then she talks about how she's been involved with saxophone players in the past and it's never worked out. So there's a parallel there. And I think with Joe and Osgood, you know, it's the fact that Joe passes off Osgood's yacht as his own. They both have a complicated romantic history, because it's like he's on his seventh or eighth marriage or whatever, whatever it is he says.
Yeah.
So through his relationship with Daphne, Osgood learns how to be a better partner and how to treat a woman properly, which is what Joe has done through the course of the film. And I think you kind of referred to this earlier. I think that's why Nobody's Perfect works so well as the final line, because it's satisfying on more than one level. Because, yeah, it's not necessarily the reaction we expect him to give, but it's also satisfying because within the framework of this farcical situation, it actually kind of makes sense. You know, this aging Lothario has found somebody to be with who's like the ideal match for him. So the fact that he's actually a man is kind of besides the point.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing that never really occurred to me when I first watched Some Like It Hot. I think it kind of works on whatever level you want it to. Like, you can just, like, kind of revel in the gags. But I think Wilder and Diamond actually put a lot of care into constructing those characters, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's absolutely spot on. I think, yeah. And that final line was originally a placeholder. Nobody's Perfect. Yeah, they put it there because they couldn't think of anything better, and they kept thinking that there would be some sort of massive zinger of a line, And little did they realise they'd already got one. You know, they'd actually already, by, you know, happenstance, come up with one that's been so celebrated over the years. But you're right. I think that's exactly what it is. I think this is a film where you can, and lots of people would quite rightly just be able to sit back and enjoy this, the light, fluffy silliness of it, and the farcical, you know, sweetness of the whole thing. And, you know, whether it's drinking in just how just stunning Marilyn is throughout this entire film as well, on a fairly base aesthetic level, but she's just stunning, both in how she looks but how she is as an actress, because I think she's sort of at the top of her game here in terms of playing that kind of, and it's ironic given how many difficulties she had during the production, how she couldn't remember lines. Apparently it took like 50 takes for her to say "it's me, sugar" at one point, because she just couldn't get her lines right because she was drinking and she was on pills and this kind of thing, which is really sad. And obviously she has a difficult end last few years before her untimely death. But it's considering she's fantastic. She's so funny. She's natural. She plays off the two leads brilliantly. And you just really care about her as a character by the end. And you just don't want her to be, you don't want her to suffer at the hands of these, you know, slightly crooked but well-meaning guys who are, yeah, you know, on the lam. So I think it just, you can enjoy it on that basic level, but there is also absolutely lots and lots of little subtext going on.
Yeah, I think in terms of like performance, I'm kind of the opinion, like, whatever they need to do to give a great performance, you know, that's fine by me. If Robert De Niro needs to go off and drive a taxi for a few months to get in the right place, that's fine. If Daniel Day-Lewis needs to go off and make shoes for 7 years between films, you know, fair enough. And if Monroe needs a few takes, then, you know, so be it.
Oh, yeah. But I think partly though, it was because she was struggling more than the method. And I think that's what I mean. Considering, I think she's still brilliant and the way it all comes together.
Yeah, definitely. I think, I want to talk a bit more about her, but I think it's interesting you talk about, yeah, she is very aesthetically pleasing. There's no getting around it. And I think it's a film that actually does something with the things that you can imagine being held against it as criticisms. So, yeah, there's a sexualized emphasis on the female body. So, like, when Monroe turns up, it's Lemon who sees her off screen, isn't it? Mm. Then we see her walking. We see the kind of rear view shot of her, for instance. They actually comment, don't they, on how she kind of, it's like Jello on springs or whatever it is they say. She must have a motor or something.
Zowie!
Yeah. But it really, really works because it's in the broader context of a narrative. Like we've said, it kind of puts its main masculine characters through these arcs where they emerge with attributes that are actually traditionally characterized as feminine. They emerge as more gentle and caring. Mm. And the film's quite clever in other ways. Like the fact that the women in the band are all really rowdy, you know, and they're not necessarily presented in an entirely stereotypically feminine way. So I can imagine somebody these days criticizing Some Like It Hot and saying it's a film that's having its cake and eating it. But I think I'd be inclined to frame that a bit more charitably. I think there's a lot of kind of a lot of care put into the way it uses things like sexuality.
Yeah, and I think some of those ancillary characters are interesting, like the character of Sue, the sort of band leader. She's great, even though she doesn't have a lot to do. She's got a difference. She's got a very sort of strong sense of, you know, femininity about her, I think, in that she's like a mother hen to these women. And you know, she was the actress who played her, Joan Shirley, she was great, I thought, in what was a fairly small role. And on that DVD, actually, four of the surviving girls in that group, as old ladies, are talking about their performance and the way they were. And, you know, they've got so many great things to say about how they were... you know, how Wilder directed them and how things were done with those characters, even though they were very small parts. But I think it's a sexy film in its own way, but I think at the same time, it's not lascivious. You know, I think that those shots of, you know, like Marilyn's rear end are in some sense playing to the established gallery of, by this point, she is like a world-renowned sex symbol. And there are going to be people going to watch this film for Marilyn in a big way. But I think then it never feels like it's just leering at her all through the film. It's a film that's very much about how, like you say, how these men develop a respect for this woman and for women generally, as in a way does Osgood in his own way. Like, and I think I think in that sense, that's where the liberal aspect of it comes in. That's where I think it's not just there for either titillation or to, you know, as a, in a disrespecting way to women. That's the take I get on it anyway. And you know, a woman might have a very different take on this. They might look back and see aspects of it that are problematic or are, you know, of their time. But frankly, honestly, I think there were films made after this that are more problematic than some, you know, at times. And you've mentioned some of the ones that have not necessarily been done in America, but in the UK as well, that are far more problematic and leery than this. So I think in that sense, yeah, it's got quite an enlightened approach.
Yeah, I think that's the thing sometimes with old Hollywood. There's maybe an assumption that these films are all much more dated than in many cases they are. I think you can go back to films of the 30s and 40s and you think, wow, this is actually pretty ahead of its time, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's talk a bit more about Monroe, because I think it's very, actually quite sophisticated the way they use her. Mm. And like I said earlier, I don't think it would have worked as well if somebody else had played that part.
No.
And I think the filmmakers are consciously drawing on her kind of broader persona. And you've kind of already mentioned the Arthur Miller thing. And I think, yeah, our knowledge of her off-screen fame adds a kind of frisson, you know. For instance, to that scene on the yacht where Sugar tries to seduce Joe. So it's just a funny idea, the fact that you've got one of, if not the most famous, desirable woman on the planet at that point in time. So yeah, you just put her through this exercise. I think maybe that's one area where a modern audience could be forgiven for being a bit more critical of Joe's deceptiveness. I do think it works in the context of this farcical narrative. But yeah, you see what I mean? It's kind of playing on the fact that she's this kind of sex symbol.
Yeah, and I mean, if this was more of a serious story, I mean, Joe wouldn't come off well, I don't think, yeah. Because he is essentially trying to trick a woman into sex, basically, you know. But I think it is, you're absolutely right in that I think it's playing on Marilyn. I mean, that scene where they're on the yacht and she kisses him, it's so steamy at the time that his glasses literally steam up. Like, so that is, even though it's still within sort of the confines of like the production code sort of way that people kiss, and it's very sort of closed mouthed and that kind of thing, it's still played, it still lingers, there's still multiple, and that's the great, there's that great like whip pan kind of thing, isn't there, going on there where it cuts from those two to, who is it it cuts to now? Because my mind's
when they're
going,
dancing, isn't it?
When Jerry, is it Jerry and
Osgood?
Daphne and Osgood are dancing. It's cutting whip pan between the two. I thought that was really good. That was a great example of trying to contrast these two. But yeah, I think it is definitely playing on Marilyn's position at that point, really. Yeah. But I think it works. I think she brings a real sort of, she brings both a glamour and a vulnerability to Sugar that I think is baked into her as a person probably as well. So I think in some ways there is a bit of an overlap between Marilyn and Sugar in a way. And maybe that is why she's so good and why, like, I mean, I think she won a Golden Globe for this back in the day. But it's such a fantastic performance. I mean, she is the standout performance even over Curtis and Lemon, as brilliant as they are.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the film, she's a very interesting figure. So I think Son Like a Hot uses her very shrewdly. It taps into her attractiveness extremely effectively. And like you say, it also utilizes her vulnerability and her capacity to play vulnerability. You know? And I think that audience members, I mean, at the time and now, because she's one of those stars who's kind of still iconic.
Yeah.
Where a lot of maybe stars of the 40s and 50s aren't household names anymore. I think most people still know who Marilyn Monroe is, don't they?
Yeah.
And I think in many cases, people are aware of some of the details of her personal life. So yeah, the succession of relationships, the difficult pregnancies she had, things like that. And I think some of that off-screen knowledge is kind of activated by the film. Like through when we learn about Sugar's backstory and she's had this kind of difficult romantic past, but also when she sings that song, like I'm Through With Love, you know, I think people bring that kind of knowledge to bear. But yeah, I think maybe this is where we could just touch on a bit of the broader context. So yeah, I think she's one of the great Hollywood stars of all time. And like, I think her celebrity status is very interesting in regards to what was going on during the 50s in terms of like women's issues, you know. So in 1953, for instance, I don't know if you're familiar with the Kinsey reports.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The second Kinsey report about women's sexuality was published in 1953, for instance. And that was the same year that Monroe was on the cover of the first edition of Playboy. And in addition, a nude picture of Monroe was the magazine centerfold in the same issue. So it comes at an interesting time in terms of change, because like Playboy was a magazine that was stocked in like regular mainstream stores. And the 50s, more broadly, it's a time when sexuality is becoming a bit more important in the culture, a bit more important in films, I think. That's why Monroe is so significant, because I think she exemplifies what the broader culture deemed to be attractive. So if you had like a hierarchy of what Western culture prized as being attractive, I think a blonde white woman would be at the top of that hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And she is like the ultimate blonde white woman. And in many respects, yeah, she's like this contradictory figure. And I think a lot of commentators have written about that. So a book called Heavenly Bodies by Richard Dyer, for instance, he writes a chapter on Monroe. And what he talks about is how her image combined sexuality with a kind of naturalness. And not everybody kind of liked that. Not everybody liked her. For a lot of people, she was just, quote-unquote, a dumb blonde, you know? Mm. But I think the interesting thing is that's a label she both played to and at times kind of resisted, you know? Like, if you look at some of her interviews, she talks about her desire to do a bit more, like to broaden her range, to do different roles. But she also had, like, this really nice line in one-liners. So I found one, I think it's in that Dyer book, but she was visiting soldiers in Korea, for example. This is 1954. And she said, "I don't know why you boys are always getting excited about sweater girls. Take away their sweaters and what have they got?" So it's like a really funny one-liner. So she knew how to kind of play to her image. So I think a lot of people have dismissed Monroe over the years, but I think there are many others who see her as a more complex figure. And I think the great thing about Some Like It Hot is it kind of knows that. It knows what what they've got in terms of Monroe, and it uses her really well. Mm.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It is aware, as we've said, on that level of who she is. But I think it brings, you know, you said the word frisson earlier. I think that's exactly what it brings. I think it brings a different complexion to this film, a different excitement in a way. And that might sound quite mercenary and quite unfair, but I think there is so often with cinema there is an overlap between the real people that these actors are and the characters they play. And I think you can, in many of the best films, you can really see often the way those things overlapped, or the influences on those performances, or what these people are drawing from, particularly in their lives. And I think that can often, I mean, in essence, that's essentially the essence of, you know, you referred to it earlier, like the method, you know, in many ways, drawing from experience. Yeah, and in this case, I think, you know, there are points with Marilyn Monroe that she's drawing from her own real life experience and the image, the persona that she puts across. And it helps lift Sugar from who would have been a funny character and a good character on the page, but I think would not have been as kinetic on screen as she is without this actor.
Yeah, well, I think that's the essence of the star system, really, is that the appeal of seeing a big star in a Hollywood film was supposed to be like, you know, this is your chance. Like the star, their personality comes through their roles, you know, that kind of idea. So like to see what Cary Grant's really like, it's up there on the screen. I mean, that's always an interesting thing. I mean, it's much more complex than that. And I think to some extent, star personas are always kind of constructed, but it's still a very potent idea. And I think there's still a real kind of romantic attachment to it. And, you know, I think, especially with somebody like Monroe, who had such a kind of interesting career. And just like I said, I think Some Like a Hot's probably her best film. Like I watched The 7 Year Itch, which is another Wilder film, last night with her, like I said. And it's a film that doesn't really work for me, as much as I like Wilder. It doesn't really work for me apart from when she's on screen.
Mm.
So I think the real virtue of this film is that it's a very good film anyway. And I think she is kind of like the icing on the cake, as it were. You know?
Yeah, the secret weapon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Tony. So I think we kind of chewed this one over. I mean, was there anything else you wanted to say before we kind of wrap up?
Not necessarily. I just think that I would say that, I mean, a lot of people, I think, who, you know, I, like you say, Marilyn Monroe is still very famous and she's still iconic. And, you know, even if few generations in this day and age don't really know who she is as much as they know the image, they know they see her on, like, you know, posters, or they
t-shirts,
see her in t-shirts, you know, with quotes and things like this, or memes or gifs or references. But I would say that if they haven't seen Some Like It Hot, go and give it a try, or recommend it to younger audiences as well, because I think there is nothing in here that younger people can't watch these days, I would say, really. But it would also give you an appreciation of just how good a comic actress she was, and just how, you know, funny and charming old Hollywood studio system comedies could be. And I think this is admittedly one of the best, and it's frequently voted as like either the best comedy or one of the best comedies. So it's kind of, it is at the top of its game. But, you know, don't let the black and white put you off. Yeah. But let, you know what I mean? As in, or, you know, as in younger audiences, put them off. Yeah. There is loads to enjoy with this.
Perfectly said, Mr. Black. I wholeheartedly endorse that message. I think it's really true. I mean, I'm confident that most people listening have probably seen Some Like It Hot.
Yes.
But...
Yeah. More a message, I suppose, from me as well, just to pass it on. That's really, I suppose, what I'm getting at.
That's true. Yeah. That's how we keep these films alive, you know, at the time when... You know, we're like decades removed from them, you know. I think, yeah. Very well said. Okay, Tony, what would you like to point people towards before we go then? Like, obviously We Made This, but maybe some other things too?
Yeah, so you can find We Made This at We Made This Pod on Twitter and WeMadeThisPod.com. You'll find links to all the podcasts, obviously including the Movie Palace over there, and all the other things hopefully you can check out. There is coming up, I think we'll talk more about this in a future episode, but there is going to be sort of, as I mentioned at the top, another podcast to keep your eye out in terms of cinema, but we'll talk more about that in future. You can find me then really personally at AJ Black Writer on Twitter, and ajblackwriter.com for any writing I'm doing and any other podcasts and projects I've got going on, really. So those are the best places.
Great stuff. So you can find me on Twitter at CKJ Sweeney. You can find the Movie Palace at Movie Palace Pod. Also on Facebook and Instagram. Our next episode is already recorded. So next Monday will be The Aviator, the Martin Scorsese film from 2004 with DiCaprio as Howard Hughes. So that'll be a fun one. That's with our mutual friend Darren Mooney. So
yeah,
hope people return for that one. Okay, so listeners, I'm going to say we're not quite done here. We've got something else up our sleeves, but it has absolutely nothing to do with Some Like It Hot. So what I'm going to do is we're going to, if you stay tuned through the end music, we'll be back. And if you don't like our singing, you can turn off now. It's fine. I think from our past exploits, you'd be forgiven for not being fond of it. I think
this is where they tune in, Carl. I don't know about anything else, like, you know.
Let's hope so. But that's all to come. So let me say, until next time, I hope you can join us again, listeners, when the curtain rises once more at the Movie Palace. Yeah, so Tony, here's the thing. I miss you. And you know why I said, because the thing is, we live very close to each other, don't we? And
We do. Several
times a year, last couple of years anyway, we've been like meeting up to go to the cinema and stuff like that, haven't we?
Yeah, yeah.
Like we've been to see 12 Angry Men, we've been to see a few other things, haven't we?
What, Apocalypse Now. Yeah.
A couple of James Bond films.
Yeah.
So I'm feeling kind of deprived at the minute. And
I know.
It's a really odd situation, isn't it? Like, you know. When is it going to be possible again? We just don't know.
I've missed my classic cinema, buddy.
Yeah, and I'll tell you one thing that always makes me feel better, you know, at times like this. Well, I'll tell you two. The first one is The Touch of a Good Woman, but the second one is...
Like Marilyn.
Well.
Yeah.
The second one is a good sing-along, so I thought we could kind of sing to each other. I don't know if that sounds good to you or what.
I love a good sing-song. As anyone will know, you know, from... Mary Poppins, particularly, you know, I've got a wonderful, terrible voice. So, you know, let's do it.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see if we're on the same page here. If I was to say to you, iconic female recording artist, where does your mind go instantly?
Well, if it's not that one shot single that Sue Pollard from Heidi Heidi wants, I would say, oh, iconic. Well, it depends how far we're going back, doesn't it? I mean, if we're going really far back, someone like Vera Lynn, maybe?
You read my mind. Now,
wow.
I like you, Tony. There's none of this Madonna, Lady Gaga. No. Dame Vera Lynn. And I think we both know which song would be most appropriate at this moment in time, don't we? And just to clarify, we're not talking about the White Cliffs of Dover. We're talking about the other one. So... And I think this is a song that's kind of broadly, it's resonant to us because we're kind of apart, but lots of other people are
too. Yeah, so. Yeah. Good lockdown song.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, here we go. 3, 2, 1. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away.
So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Hey!
Stay safe, Tony.
And you, mate. And you.
Previously on the We Made This Network. The Giddy Carousel of Pop.
Carol Decker from T'Pau, who were actually at number one with China in Your Hand when this issue of Smash Hits was in your newsagents.
Carol's really up for it. She knows what the kids want. They want stories about being sick in a cowboy boot, so they get that. I've fallen asleep with my head down a toilet many a time, and Ronnie, who's out of the band, her boyfriend, has helped me throw up into a bucket.
She's a short-tempered bitch, according to what it says here in the article.
Didn't she throw some stuff at him?
Yes.
Life's milestones.
So let's move on and talk about birth. When and where and how were you born?
Through the vagina, I believe.
Oh. I've literally just said what a great man you are, and you're really crude. Literal person.
I was born at the outset of the National Health Service in 1947.
Free with this month's issue.
When we supported them, we brought loads of like family and friends and people. My parents and my sister came, and as everybody was walking along the drive to get up there, their tour bus was there, and their guitarist was standing in the doorway beckoning at lots of underage girls while wearing a t-shirt that said drugs, unsuccessfully, and I think in a joking way that he was sort of beckoning. Okay. But
would have got me.
My mum was not very impressed. Neither was my girlfriend at the time, Kelly, because I wouldn't let her go on the fucking tour.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.